The overture to the opera Don Giovanni by Mozart, the Academy of St Martin in the Fields, was conducted by Sir Neville Mariner. And so this edition of Sunday Morning draws to a close. I do hope you've found it interesting and thank you so much for listening. Next week, James is back again with his own custom-built selection. I'll be listening at home while raiding my own shelves for my next appointment with you, which will be in 3 weeks' time. In the meantime, enjoy your listening and please do join James next Sunday, same time, next at 9 o'clock here on Radio 3.
Sunday Morning with Rob Cowan is a unique production for BBC Radio 3 with studio production this morning by Lyndon Jones.
Venezuelan dynamo Gustavo Dudamel returns to London to conduct the Philharmonia in Gustav Mahler's 7th Symphony. From its opening funeral march to its blazing, optimistic ending. Dudamel conducts Mahler 7 live at the Royal Festival Hall in London. Radio 3 live in concert Thursday evening at 7:30.
Well, this is BBC Radio 3. The time now is 12 o'clock, time for Private Passions. Michael Barclay's guest today is the biographer and art critic Martin Gayford.
Martin Gayford has a passion for painting and music and has spent his career writing about artists, Constable, Van Gogh, David Hockney, Lucian Freud, and indeed thinking about the connection between art and music. His new biography of Michelangelo, if you're Italian, is published this week, and we've taken that excuse, Martin, to explore with you the musical worlds of some of our greatest painters. I know that while you've been working on Michelangelo, you've also been listening to the music that you imagine he really loved.
Yes, it's really a way of getting close to my subject. I've been listening to the music which would have surrounded him from his teenage years when he was in the household of Lorenzo the Magnificent in Florence, throughout his career, a lot of which was spent in Rome, in and around the Sistine Chapel. And one of the people I discovered, was a discovery for me at any rate, was a Flemish musician called Jacques Archedelt. There isn't actual connection there, because Archedelt set a couple of Michelangelo's poems to music. He was a great madrigal composer, Archedelt, and there are some letters in which Michelangelo responds, and he asks what would be an appropriate gift, whether he ought to give him some satin for a doublet, or maybe some silk, or a bit of money, or anyway, he must have heard Archedelt, because Archedelt was in the Sistine Choir while he was painting The Last Judgment, so in the late 1530s, early 1540s.
So the music we're going to begin with then is something that while he was on the scaffold, and we're now talking about the painting scaffold, fortunately, yeah. He might well have heard the choir rehearsing this Archedelt. Actually, Archedelt was a wonderful polyphonist. I think I've sung his music.
I think he must have heard services in the Sistine Chapel, and possibly they were rehearsed while he was up on the scaffolding painting. Very likely, I should think. I've chosen a Gloria from a Mass rather than one of the madrigals, which Archedelt was also very famous for. It's a fantastic example of the kind of music which would have been part of the whole setting of the Sistine Chapel. The whole thing was intended as a totality. I think we forget that now because we just go and look at the
pictures.
Wonderful
to imagine this bouncing round the Sistine Chapel while Michelangelo was painting those glorious things on the ceiling.
Yes, and I think the paintings and the vestments and the music was all intended to be a total experience and as glorious as possible.
Thank you.
The Gloria from Missa Ave Regina Caelorum, composed by Jacques Archedelt and sung by Musica Contexta with the English Cornet and Sackbut Ensemble. I certainly did sing that as a choir boy. It all came back to me. It also made me wonder, Martin Gayford, whether perhaps the boys might have been, as we all are prone to be, a little distracted by this creature up on the scaffold painting away.
Well, if he was visible, there might have been sort of curtaining in front of the Last Judgment, but there was certainly a lot of noise at points when he was doing the Sistine Ceiling. There's a complaint from the papal master of ceremonies that a service had to be delayed because his workmen were making such a noise and there's so much dust up on the scaffolding.
Maybe he was thinking about what he was going to have for lunch, because another one of his passions is also one of yours, and that's food. And he wrote poems about food, of course.
What he did was write poems in thanks for food. In the 1540s, about the time that Archedelt was setting these madrigals of his to music, he wrote over 100 epitaphs for a friend of his whose nephew had died. And the friend wanted Michelangelo to do a sculpted tomb. And Michelangelo obviously didn't want to have anything to do with that. So instead, he made his suggestion rather elegantly. He'd compose epitaphs. And after a while, you know, unseemly way, he starts joking about it. His friend was obviously sending him presents of food, so he'd send a poem back with, "This is for the marinated mushrooms, this is for the melons, this is for the duck, but don't put too much pepper on it," that kind.
Well, you might be thinking ahead, because we'll probably get you to give us a recipe, which we've done once or twice on the programme. People really rather enjoy it, so I'll let you store that up. Before we move on to your next artist, let's hear a little bit more about your own musical life, and particularly your passion for jazz.
Well, yes, this next piece I've chosen is one of the first pieces of music I consciously heard, because my father had sort of left lying around an album of recordings by Duke Ellington, which he'd bought when he was at school. And we had a 78 gramophone, which I was allowed to use when I was 4 or 5. And these must have had quite an effect on the formative moment, these Ellington recordings.
And why is this piece in particular special for you?
Well, I just think it's a lovely piece of Ellington, and it's called Mood Indigo. It's one of the very first pieces of jazz which people who are interested in European classical music responded to. People were writing, "Oh, this must be connected with Ravel," and Ellington said, "Well, actually, I'd never heard of Ravel when I composed it." But it does what I like very much in music, which is set a scene, paint a picture. And it's also got a wonderful clarinet, lower register clarinet solo, which is something I'm very fond of.
So it all has a kind of rather curious, magical, almost at times ethereal quality.
Slightly eerie quality. Well, he did something which is very jazz. He improvised, I understand, in the studio. He discovered that the microphone they were using resonated with the lower register of the clarinet. So that's one of the reasons why you get this sort of slightly hollow, eerie sound.
Thank you.
That was Mood Indigo, which, by the way, the clarinetist there, Barney Bigard, always claimed was largely his composition and felt that he'd been done out of royalties by Ellington.
It was fascinating the way that low clarinet underneath the saxophones gave a kind of quality, which almost adds another presence, doesn't it?
Yes. Well, I think that sounds, if that was Ellington's bright idea, that he realised the microphone was doing. But the clarinet line seems to have been passed around by New Orleans musicians for some years before it ended up on that recording.
I don't want to sort of push the metaphors too far, but, I mean, is there something for you in the way that what we've just been talking about is perhaps like using layers of paint, creating resonances and echoes and presences through the way you use paint, or is that stretching the imagination too far?
I think it's probably no accident that it ended up being called Mood Indigo, which is the colour, although it started out as Dreamy Blues, actually. I think Ellington thought in terms of what's called tone colour, and it's not an accidental phrase, so he's a very colouristic composer.
Well, we heard Duke Ellington and Barney Bigard's Mood Indigo. We heard the original 1930 recording of Duke Ellington and his orchestra. This next piece is for one of the artists you've written about, John Constable, and he was a musician too, wasn't he?
Yes, I would say he was in a more straightforward way. He was he was much more musical than Michelangelo, who seems to have sort of backed into music. Had a rather difficult relationship with it. Constable was a flautist, apparently quite an accomplished flautist, and he does quite frequently in his writing exactly what we were just talking about, which is that he makes an analogy between an artist, a picture, and a composer. One of his most famous lines is that the sky is the chief organ of sentiment in a picture, and by that he meant, I think, pipe organ. Music, the musical instrument, because he also says it's the keynote, so his skies presumably could be in, you know, D major or E minor.
So what have you chosen to represent Constable, if you like music?
Well, this is a rather complicated choice. I've chosen what he and his bride-to-be Maria Bicknell didn't hear in March 1814, and in my book, I describe how they went to see a performance of Richard III in a theatre in Covent Garden, and afterwards she wrote and said it was rather gloomy and it had depressed them. They were in a rather sort of fraught condition because their match was opposed by her father, and it would have been much better to hear the music on the previous evening, which was in fact Haydn's creation. And from that, I've chosen four Constable, really. I've chosen the archangels describing the creation of the natural world, the green hills, the birds and the fish, all of which I think Constable was very interested in. The first, obviously, but he was also writes quite a bit about birds, and he was a keen fisherman, which I think is one of the clues to his interest in landscape, because what do fishermen do? They sit still in the landscape, concentrating.
Thank you. Is great in his might. That trio and chorus from Haydn's Creation was performed by Margaret Marshall singing Gabriel, Vincent Cole as Uriel, and Gwyn Howell, Raphael, with the Bavarian Radio Chorus, Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra, all conducted by Raphael Kubelik. And there is that sort of delight in animal sounds and colour painting. Because there we had, you know, I command the ocean to be full of living creatures, command birds to fly above the earth. And do you think that probably artists, in a way, slightly set out their stall to a certain extent in the same way as composers.
Yes, I think that Constable's reference to the keynote is pretty important with painting. In setting out the colours for a picture, you would key everything to a particular colour note. So it was obvious to me when, for example, Lucian Freud was painted a portrait of me, which is called Man with a Blue Scarf. It's got a royal blue scarf in the middle of it, and I could see that every other colour in the picture was keyed to that. And when, at a crucial moment, I turned up with the wrong blue scarf on, Lucien just couldn't paint at all because it had to be that precise blue. And I'm sure, I mean, Van Gogh was the same. He complained that it was driving him to drink, working out these complicated colour harmonies for his pictures.
Well, that would be true if for some reason while you were composing something or even hearing it being performed, it was starting to be done in a different key or different tuning, or even if you were suddenly told, well, string quartet you've been writing is now going to be a brass quartet.
It would change everything.
Well, the next music that you've chosen is rather extraordinary because it actually, if you like, dramatises the process of composition, doesn't it? It's Thelonious Monk.
Yes, who's in a way, it must seem rather an abrupt change from Haydn's creation, but I love actually, and for his angularity and his way, the way he's, although what he's doing might seem rather sort of wild and free, actually he's, I think, rather carefully reimagining what music could be. And I think you can hear in this piece, well, firstly, he's understood that the piano is a percussion instrument. So while the drums are quite melodic at points, he's fiercely rhythmic in his playing. And it's
and all, what playing?
Yes. And it's also, it's a bit visual. He was very good on titles. This one's called Brilliant Corners, which you can sort of almost see. And it fits the strange angularity of this piece, which, by the way, the musicians just couldn't play in the recording studio, according to the producer. This is put together from, there were 24 takes of it because they just couldn't negotiate the oddity of the structure and the changes in tempo.
Yes, and it comes from about 1957, I think.
That's right, yes. And it's got Sonny Rollins in his prime on it playing tenor saxophone. Thelonious Monk playing with Sonny Rollins there. And there's a slightly biographical reason for picking that as well, because Monk was the first jazz musician I actually heard live rather than on records. I'd read about him, but I'd not seen him when I was in the sixth form at school, and I discovered he was coming to Hammersmith, and I went with some friends, and it was tremendously exciting.
Thelonious Monk's Brilliant Corners from his 1957 album of the same name. And we heard, as you said, Thelonious Monk and his band, Ernie Henry, who was playing alto sax, and I gather almost had a breakdown by the time they got to the end. Sonny Rollins, tenor sax, Oscar Pettiford, bass, and Max Roach, drums. We were talking about the connection between painting and music. And, of course, some people actually have synesthesia, don't they, where they actually see colours when they hear music.
Yes, and a lot of painters in the 19th, early 20th century were very interested in that and claimed to have it. Whether or not they actually did is not quite clear. Amongst whom were both Van Gogh and Gauguin. Gauguin writes that when he left a Beethoven concert, his head was vibrating with different colours. He might have been making it up a bit. Van Gogh also, at one point apparently, tried to have himself taught the organ by the organist at Eindhoven, which was a sort of nearby town where he was living with his parents at the time. It was in the mid-1880s. But because he constantly said that that chord is Prussian blue or that one's cadmium yellow, the organist concluded that he was off his head and stopped the lessons.
Mm. And keys, funnily enough, many composers... Messiaen is one, would see a key as being a particular colour. In other words, there was a predominant blue for A major or whatever it was, for example.
Well, the jazz pianist Marion McPartland has said the key of D is daffodil yellow.
Well, that would be rather good for Van Gogh.
Yes. Well, actually, he talked about the high yellow note of his work in Arles. So perhaps I think he was thinking in terms of music as well.
And I think this piece you've chosen because of Van Gogh.
Well, because of Van Gogh and Gauguin is Debussy. And Debussy sort of oddly allied with Gauguin because, although Gauguin never mentions him, or Debussy-Gauguin, as far as I know, they shared a guardian, so they must have been aware of each other. Gauguin was rather older. And they also both turned up to Mallarmé's Tuesday afternoon soirees in the mid-1890s, so they must have known each other. And while Gauguin was the symbolist painter par excellence, Debussy was the symbolist composer. And, well, I've chosen him partly because I've always really loved his piano music, and it does exactly what we were talking about earlier on. It's extremely, or often I found, extremely visual. And particularly this piece, which is called Poisson d'Or, just makes me see goldfish darting around. Thank you.
such a wonderful imagination at work there. You really can see fish darting about, can't you?
Yes, and like quite a lot of Debussy's works, it's all about water and reflections, and in fact the subjects which are the subjects of a lot of Impressionist paintings.
But you know, he actually said that quite often he put the title on afterwards.
Well, and it is also very abstract. But well, that actually is a sort of analogy with painting. That abstract painters will often say that actually they were just thinking about colour and shape when they produce the work, but afterwards you almost invariably discover it looks like something.
Yes, that's fascinating. Almost a subconscious reference to, and maybe that brings up that fascinating point that nothing is totally innovative. Everything is a reworking of something in our experience, conscious or subconscious.
Yes. Yes, I once to a jazz musician, I incautiously said something about Louis Armstrong inventing jazz, and he said, what did he invent? The chord of C.
We heard Poisson d'Or by Debussy. And here we've got ourselves into a bit of a conundrum, Martin Gayford, because it was played by Arturo Benedetti Michelangeli, and we wouldn't say Michelangeli.
No, Michelangeli.
You mentioned, Martin, sitting for Lucian Freud, and knowing how long his pictures took to paint, that must have been quite an exhaustive and extraordinary experience.
It was quite a marathon. About halfway through, it struck me that I was seeing more of him than of any other human being, with the possible exception of my wife and children. So there were it involved many hours of sitting and also eating afterwards in restaurants, going around London in taxis, lots and lots of talk.
Did you ever feel nervous when you were sitting for that portrait with Lucian, or did you feel tranquil?
Almost all the time I felt pretty interested, actually, although I will admit that towards the end I started to wonder whether it was ever going to come to completion. After 8 or 9 months of sitting, one gets a little bit jumpy. And in the middle, I hadn't felt nervous. I'd felt rather happy about the whole thing, but I was telling a friend about it, and she said, you're brave. And that made me feel, oh, I wonder what he's going to turn out like.
Could you see what he was doing, or did he have the back of the canvas to you?
Oh, yes. Every half an hour or so, he'd say, let's take a break. And I'd get up and stretch and stroll around and have a look to see if there'd been any visible changes, because the progress was pretty gradual. I mean, sometimes you'd see, my upper lip started to go in, or there's a bit of my ear. But sometimes it wasn't quite clear what he'd been doing for the previous half an hour. We went quite often to jazz concerts, so I always got two tickets, and if I thought it was something that would interest him, I'd say, well, do you want to come along and listen to this? And so we went to see Ray Charles, for example. I remember him, which was a very good concert, in which Ray Charles had a steaming argument with the sound man halfway through and threatened to walk off stage. It was marvellous music, and Lucian walked out saying, he really knows how to wear clothes, doesn't he?
This next piece, I think, is a piece of jazz that you listened to together.
Well, we listened to the cornetist on this, Warren Vacher. It was to be about the year 2000. I think this was recorded in 2001, this piece we're going to hear. And what we heard was Warren playing with duets with a pianist, and it was a very nice night. And I remember Lucian commenting on the high quality of the music.
Darn That Dream, originally a Jimmy Van Huysen number, but performed there by Warren Vacher and Bill Charlap. It is extraordinary, that improvisatory gift. I tend to find with classical musicians that they either need the music to play from or that they can improvise. And if they can improvise, they're usually not quite such good sight readers, as certainly is my case. But I suppose with jazz, it's all about improvisation, but some of the best ones could also play from the music quite brilliantly.
Yes, and I think musicians vary, jazz musicians, in the extent to which they freely improvise every time. You can hear with Charlie Parker, for example, one can listen to six takes of a tune and they're all completely different, whereas other people, one will hear year after year playing variations on essentially the same solo and the same tune. So there's a limit how much they're actually improvising, but on the other hand, the solo is never written down.
Did Lucian Freud cook? Was he interested in food?
Yes, he was. He was actually belonged to the same school of cookery as I do, which is the Elizabeth David School.
And did he paint food that he cooked?
Because his method was so slow, food
might not have been very good. But
food presented some problems. Actually, he did do still lives. He did five eggs for the Duchess of Devonshire, and after a while, he announced that he'd noticed they all had different personalities.
Opera next, and it's not surprising that painters love the visual spectacle of opera. The piece you've chosen was given a great new lease of life, I think, to be honest, by David Hockney at Glyndebourne. You went with him to one of
yes.
those productions.
Yes, it was a very happy meeting between Hockney and Stravinsky's Rake's Progress. It was his first opera design in 1975, and it marked a change in his career. And it also, it seems to me, completed the work, so that it's now hard to imagine his designs without the music and words.
Which bit are we going to hear?
This is right at the end of the first act. The heroine, Anne True Love, is wondering whether to go to London to rescue the rake, Tom Rakewell, who's been lured away by the devil, in fact.
Or whether Nick Shadow.
Nick Shadow, precisely. Or whether she ought to stay with in the country with her father. I think it's an absolutely beautiful aria and one of the highlights of the whole opera.
My father, can I desert him? And his devotion for a love who has deserted me? No, my father has strength of purpose, while Tom is weak and needs the comfort of a helping hand. Oh, God, bless.
quintessential Stravinsky, that. My father and I go to him from Act 1, Scene 3 of Stravinsky's Rake's Progress. We heard Jane West as Anne Truelove with the Orchestra of St. Luke's conducted by Robert Kraft. There are several versions of the Stravinsky Rake's Progress, so it might help if you want to know more about it. All the details are on the Radio 3 website. And you can also download this programme, and indeed many others, in the series. You work from home, Martin Gayford. I wonder, actually I don't really, because I think I know the answer to this. Do you listen to music for inspiration while you work?
Not while I work, but afterwards. I know some people can work with music in the background, but I would find it completely jamming, because my own feeling about writing is it's all about rhythm, and having a different rhythm in the background would make it impossible. But I do listen in the evening and when I'm cooking, that sort of thing.
You've been actually experimenting, I think, with some recipes of another artist you're fond of.
Well, there's a connection between Van Gogh and Gauguin, we were talking about earlier on, and Toulouse-Lautrec, who was a friend of Van Gogh's, particularly from an arts atelier in Paris where they both studied. And one of Van Gogh's dreams about his yellow house in Arles was that they'd be doing their own cooking, which as soon as Gauguin turned up, he put into practice. But according to Gauguin, Van Gogh only cooked one dish, which was soup, and it was inedible. So from then on, Gauguin did all the cooking. Mm. We don't have any recipes of his, but Toulouse-Lautrec was quite a famous cook in rather the Elizabeth David style, those sort of simple French provincial dishes.
And I think of him more as a sort of Rake's Progress kind of character in some ways, as a painter.
Yes. Well, yes, he's more louche and so forth, but yeah. but people would people look forward to his food, apparently, and a book was published after he died. And I think one recipe, if they didn't cook it in the Yellow House, they should have done, because it's so coloristically perfect for Vincent and Gauguin, which is Toulouse-Lautrec's recipe for pumpkin au gratin, which is essentially pumpkin, slice of pumpkin in flour, fried in oil, then layered with tomato sauce with breadcrumbs on the top. So very simple, but a wonderful splash of yellow and red.
We might ask you to give us the recipe and put it on that aforementioned web page.
A pleasure.
While you're pulverising the pumpkin, this is the music that you pulverise too.
Well, I've been listening to Billie Holiday for really practically my whole life, and particularly love the recording she made in the late 1930s with tenor saxophonist Lester Young, who's one of my absolutely favourite musicians as well. He's the person who invented cool, it seems to me, and transformed jazz and sensibility, really. And here's one other last analogy between painting and music. Lucian always used to say that one of the most difficult things in painting was painting people together so they occupied the same space and seemed to be emotionally linked with each other. And similarly, in music, all kinds of music, playing together is absolutely crucial. And I don't think there's a better example in any type of music of togetherness than Billie Holiday and Lester Young. As you'll hear on this piece, Mean to Me, effectively, it's the same voice.
Martin Gayford, thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Billie Holiday, ending that edition of Private Passions. Michael Barclay was talking to Martin Gayford. The producer was Elizabeth Burke, and it was a Loftus production for BBC Radio 3. And for all the music details and information about how to download the programme, do have a look at the Private Passions page on the Radio 3 website. Next week, Michael's guest is the novelist Michelle Roberts.
On BBC Two.
Just over 20 years ago, Britain came to the end of one of the longest wars in our history. It was a war that made our Britain.
Dominic Sambrook looks back at five decades of a divided world.
This was a war between us, the capitalist West, and them, the totalitarian East.
A time that shaped the nation through hope and terror.
Britain was promising its children longer and healthier lives than ever, and yet it was also planning for Armageddon.
Strange Days, Cold War Britain, starts Tuesday night at 9 on BBC Two and BBC Two HD.
Well, this is BBC Radio 3. We're on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and also online. It's just after 1 o'clock. I'm Jill Anderson, and here's a summary of the news. A big international relief effort is being organised in the Philippines, where more than 4 million people have been affected by Typhoon Chaiyan. Up to 10,000 people are thought to have died in the worst-hit region, and many bodies are being buried in mass graves. The disaster has left many people with no clean water or electricity and little food. Military cargo planes are delivering supplies, and hundreds of troops and police are being sent to stop the widespread looting. The head of the armed forces has said due process should be followed in the sentencing of a Royal Marine convicted of murder in Afghanistan. General Sir Nicholas Houghton said the armed forces should not expect special treatment. The Defence Secretary, Philip Hammond, has said the values which separate British troops from the terrorists they're fighting must be maintained. The Foreign Secretary, William Hague, says an agreement to limit Iran's nuclear programme is close to being reached, despite the failure of talks in Geneva yesterday. Mr Hague said a deal was on the table and negotiations would continue in 10 days' time. India's Prime Minister Manmohan Singh has decided not to attend the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in Sri Lanka. He follows the Canadian Premier, Stephen Harper, who said he would be staying away from the conference because of concerns about human rights abuses. No official explanation has been given for Mr Singh's decision, but he's been urged to boycott the gathering because of allegations of war crimes by Sri Lankan forces during their defeat of the Tamil Tigers. Thousands of military veterans and civilians have joined the Queen at the Cenotaph in London to mark Remembrance Sunday. 2 minutes' silence was observed at 11 o'clock. Members of Churchill's Secret Army, which was formed to overthrow German rule in the event of an invasion, joined the event for the first time. And the weather. After a cold start, most places will enjoy a good deal of sunshine. Clouds will clear from the east of England this evening, and there'll be some rain over the western tip of Cornwall. And that's the BBC News and weather at 3 minutes past one. Well, looking ahead to this evening, our Live in Concert is a performance of Britain's War Requiem, written specially for the consecration of Coventry Cathedral after its destruction in the Second World War. The soloists will be Sabina Svilak, Andrew Kennedy and Roderick Williams, with the Crouch End Festival Chorus, the Choristers of Westminster Abbey, the BBC Symphony Chorus and the BBC Symphony Orchestra, all conducted by Semyon Bishkov. And you can hear Britain's War Requiem live here on Radio 3 starting at 7 o'clock this evening. Well, for our lunchtime concert today, we'll hear the Endelian Quartet play the final quartet by Beethoven, the F major opus 135. But to begin, Haydn's D major string quartet, opus 20, number 4. It's from a set known as the Sun Quartets, owing to an emblem on the cover of the early editions, and it was composed in 1772. This is not the most sunny, but perhaps the most vigorous of the set. The very lively opening movement has overtones of Sturm und Drang, and the second movement begins with a mournful melody for the violin. Haydn turns to gypsy music for the minuet, and after a brisk scherzo, brings the quartet to a surprisingly gentle close.